In my family, mental illness waits like an unseen sniper. Patient, stalking, lurking, aiming. Then, in the middle of a bright sunny day, unexpected, pow! She pulls the trigger, taking another one of us down. Pow! And you never know who's gonna get hit and who's gonna get the blowback. And you can't help but wonder where she's aiming next. Pow! You think he was good people. He had a bright future, but the monster stole it. And deep down, you know that I'm not any better than him or her. And I wonder if the next shot is gonna get me. Today on Snap Judgment, lucky. Amazing stories of people who make it through due to no fault of their own. My name is Glenn Washington, and it is always better to be lucky than to be smart when you're listening to Snap Judgment. This week on Snap, we get to feature a collaboration with producer Brianna Breen from the Lucky Podcast. And Brianna brings us a story of one of Yugoslavia's top basketball players.
Since I was 13 years old, I was this tall, 6'3", and fell in love with the game of basketball. I played first division in Yugoslavia. That's like WNBA here in America.
Her name is Nana Rothbard. And in her country, she's widely regarded as one of the best players to step on the court.
Coaches said that I was one of the most talented players the country ever had. I loved it so much, I never wanted to leave. I played all the way until I found out that I was pregnant. And I remember that day we were warming up and I just couldn't feel right. It felt like somebody's pulling my legs down. I couldn't jump. And then that week I found out I was pregnant. So I didn't play, of course. I didn't play after that.
Nana's story takes place in 1992, about 5 years after she left the league and opened her own law office. Now married and a mother of two, she's focused on building a future with her family. But what Nana doesn't know is that the country she calls home is on the brink of collapse.
My husband and I, my two little kids, 4.5 years old and 5.5 years old, we lived with my in-laws. We were sitting at the dinner table and we started hearing unusual noises outside of the window. I looked through the window. It was unbelievable amount of people walking from one side of the town towards downtown, hundreds of people yelling. It was scary. And suddenly I heard a gunshot in front of our balcony. It was a sound I've never heard before. My husband went through the door immediately to see what's going on. And later on TV, we heard that was a first victim of war. I just said that was a sound I've never heard before, and I just realized it's not true. Several months before war started, we would go to concerts on the top of the hill in Sarajevo. And my husband and my best friend Aida, we are going up to catch a concert, and we hear gunshots, maybe a street or two down. And we stopped. I don't remember who said, oh, it's not in our street. So these things were happening slowly, gradually, to the point that you're able to say, oh, this is not in my street. I'm going to the concert. That night, my husband said, I don't think we will have war in Bosnia because the nationalities are so equal that nobody can win this war. At that time, Bosnia had three major nationalities, Serbs, Croats, and Muslims. Among all our friends, there was always Serbs, Muslims, Croats, and I'm Jewish. We had neighbors with all nationalities and religions. We were all friends. We celebrated everybody's holidays. My in-laws were Serbs, and I learned how to celebrate their Christmas. We felt nothing will ever divide us. First 10 days, maybe, we had a somewhat normal life. Shooting was only during the night, and during the day, we were going to work. Kids were going out to play. My father called from Serbia, saying, pack your bags and run. I said, oh, don't worry, Dad. They're just shooting over our buildings. They're not shooting at us. And he, being the only Holocaust survivor in his family, was terrified. He said to me, Nada, if you have any chance, pick up your kids and leave. I remember saying, they will stop in day or two. Everybody's saying they will stop, and I want to keep working in my office. He said to me, Nada, 6 million Jews died because they were holding on their offices, their stores, their lives, their houses, because they didn't know that something like this can happen. Who could know that? Who could predict something like this? But your entire family died in Auschwitz, so you know you don't repeat the same mistake. It took me at least 20 days to figure out that it's actually a war. In some level, I thought, maybe somebody is shooting a movie about the war in my neighborhood. And I remember thinking, that's pretty crazy thought. You know better. It's very hard to accept that your entire life is gone. Everything you ever worked for, learned, studied, accomplished, planned, it's absolutely gone. I went to work until one day I was all dressed up and ready to go, and I remember grabbing the door handle. The biggest bomb exploded, and it was in the middle of the day. And I remember stopping and saying, well, they will be okay if I miss one day. And from that day, I wasn't going to work at all. Sarajevo was divided by the river Miljacka. Miljacka was a beautiful river that had bridges to connect us. When war started, Miljacka divided the town in two. And I have never known before war that I lived in so-called Serbian part. So now I'm living in a Serbian side of the town. Mountains that are on my side are filled with Serbian tanks and soldiers. They're shooting across the river to the Muslim side of the town. Muslim side of the mountains are filled with their soldiers and tanks, and they're shooting across the river. And one of the first victims was a little 2 years old that was sleeping in a crib. She was a Muslim little girl living in a Serbian side of the town, so Muslims killed her, hoping to kill somebody who is a Serb. It's just a representation of absolute nonsense of what happened and how these wars are absolute tragedy. The Serbs put an announcement, if you are a male from this age to this age, maybe 16 to 68, something like that, you need to report to join the army. As soon as my husband saw this, he came home, gave me 5,000 Deutschmarks in cash. That was a huge amount of money for Yugoslavia at that time. and he says, I'm not going to join the army, I'm leaving. He didn't kiss the kids, he didn't hug and kiss me, he just left. I can just guess that it was too hard to say goodbye. I remember closing the door and saying, now it's up to me. I have two old parents here. I have two little kids here, and I need to keep this together. If I can remember correctly, it's maybe a few days, just a few days. Things started getting worse and worse and worse. Serbs surrounded every building and came with tanks and heavy ammunition. Some soldiers were holding these rockets on their shoulders, and when they shoot somewhere, that produces an amazing sound, and the whole building would shake many, many times. From the shaking, the building material would get all over the house in our hair and skin. Very quickly figured out that the safest thing to do is to cover all the windows and place the shelves with books and all the cushiony stuff from the sofas, mattresses, because the bullets and pieces of the bomb would be stuck in the fabric of the mattress and the layers of the books. Every time when we hear sirens, we would go down in basement and stay there until we feel we are safe to come up. Of course, if the bomb explodes on top of our building, we would be all underneath. There was absolutely no safe place for us. The only thing we had as far as food is 100 kilos of sauerkraut, and we have probably a case of oil. Every single day, I cut sour cabbage and put a little olive oil as a salad and a little red paprika. Try eating this every day with absolutely nothing else. It's healthy, it's probiotic, but there's absolutely nothing in your stomach. One particular day, I experienced a horrible banging on the door. I opened the door and I see 17 guys in front of me. I counted them all. The first guy standing in front of me is taller than me with a line of bullets across his shoulders and machine guns. Start assessing the situation and the guy says, what's your name? So I said, Nada Rothbart. What's Rothbart? What last name is this? I said, it's mine. He wants to know, am I Serbian? He wants to know, is he going to kill me or not? What is he going to do?
You're listening to Snap Judgment, the lucky episode. In just a moment, find out what Nada decides when her decision means everything. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Snap Judgment, the lucky episode. When last we left Nada, she's standing in her doorway, facing down two soldiers, each armed to the teeth. One of the soldiers has a question.
He wants to know, am I Serbian? He wants to know, is he going to kill me or not? What is he going to do? He wants to know, am I Serbian? He wants to know, is he going to kill me or not? What is he going to do? And I just found the kindest and the warmest voice. And I said, listen, gentlemen, we don't have anything here for you. He asked me immediately, where's your husband? I said, he's gone. So I opened the doors wide open. So I'm not hiding anything. And I said, we have here my in-laws. They're old and sick in the bedroom. I have two little kids and me. There's nothing here, really. And I just stood there and looked straight into his eyes. I gave him respect, and I stood my ground. several long seconds of silence, he says, okay, let's go, guys. And they turn around and left. Later, I heard that they got into every apartment. They beat people up. They came to steal anything of value. One of the nights being in a basement, my neighbor, who was at that time 60, really broke down, almost like a nervous breakdown, yelling at me, how dare you keep your kids here? Everybody left with the small kids and you stayed here with your little kids. I don't know why you're still here. But at that time, I didn't have any way out. There was no way out. Had the deepest pain in the bottom of my stomach, really knowing that I kept my two precious sons in that situation, and I could have left earlier, and I am responsible for their life or possibly death. It was tearing me apart. I was convinced we're all going to be dead here. One morning, it was quiet, unusually quiet, and I opened the drawer in the living room and I found a transistor radio. I didn't know I owned one, and I listened to the news. There was going to be a 5-day ceasefire starting that day. From the experience, a ceasefire would happen, except for it would last 20 minutes and then somebody would shoot and then war starts again. I said, let's go. Put my feet into the first shoes I found. I knew instinctively this is the place I will never come back again. So we walked out. My mother-in-law walked with us maybe for 2 minutes. And she just said, well, I will say goodbye. Her husband had a stroke for 10 years and he was in bed. She was not going to leave him. So we just briefly gave each other a hug. I didn't turn around to see her. There was no looking back. This is Yugoslavia as my hand. In the middle of the hand is Sarajevo. On the right side, more towards the north, is Serbia Novi Sad. We were going towards that direction, going to my hometown, when I saw a new formed barricade and around 50 to 60 women and kids. Kids crying and women yelling, I want to go. And so everybody heard on the radio there will be ceasefire and they're trying to go. So the army is stopping us and saying, who are you and where are you going? We are standing in the back of that line when suddenly one of the soldiers that appeared to be the main guy in that barricade said, hey, Nada, come here. Didn't know is it good or bad. And I started walking to the front of the line and I come close to him and I recognize him. He's one of these faithful fans from my basketball years that meet you in a bus or on the street and says, oh, I've watched your game last night. You played really well. And I would always politely thank him and stop and talk to him. Suddenly, he's in a uniform and my life depends on what he's going to decide. We say, oh, I'm going to help you. Hey, buddy, come on over. Help this woman and these kids go to where do you want to go? The first place I had in mind to go was Pale, a little village, Pale. If I made it there, there was no bombing there. It's on the top of the hill where actually Serbian authorities and a president were located at that time. So if I make it there, I could hope to survive. So now this guy shows up with a car, beat up car full of ammunition, bombs, everything. He looks like bad news. But he was asked to help us. Kids started to cry immediately. And I said, hey, don't worry about anything. This is a really good man. He's going to help us. And I made a crucial mistake. I gave him $100 worth of money to motivate him to help us. He took the money, which was at that time a yearly salary in Yugoslavia. He took the money, drove us literally around the corner of that building, opened the door, and cast us out. Get out of here, you piece of dot, dot, dot. And we just got out. So no problems, no problem. Thank you so much. Thank you. My kids are screaming and crying, and I hug them and kiss them and kneel down. I said, everything will be okay. We'll be fine. So we kept going, walking, and suddenly there was a field full of women, refugees, old women and women with kids, and unbelievable amount of army trucks. Every truck was full. And I thought, I'm the luckiest person if I can get the permission to go in the back of the truck with my kids to get out of Sarajevo. And I asked the driver, I said, is this okay if my kids and I go up there? He looked at me and my beautiful kids and says, no, ma'am, I will find something better for you. He walked me around and found me another truck. And I walked in the back of the truck, who was two-thirds of the truck were ammunition and food. And there was six soldiers. I put Robert, the older son, on the farther side, the younger son, in my lap, hugging both of them so they have no contact with any soldiers. And we started our journey. I thought, this is it. These people are going to drive us and we're going to be safe. After around 15 minutes, interrogation started. They started asking my kids questions. What are your names? What is your religious holiday? So I'm Jewish and I never taught them any of our holidays. I grew up playing basketball and not too much in a religious world. They knew I was Jewish, but that was not on the top of their head. We celebrated their father's Serbian holidays. And they started telling them the right answers because they were Serbian soldiers. We celebrate Christmas, we celebrate this, we celebrate that. They said, what is your grandma's name? What is your grandfather's name? They just went through all the questions, and I knew for sure that they're, if we were Croats or Muslims, they would kill us, and that would be the end of it. So one of the last questions is, what's your father's name? My father's name is Zoran Kajmaković, and the soldier next to me says, oh, I know him. He's a best friend of my neighbor. He's a really good guy. I said, yes, yes, he is. And from that moment, the energy relaxes. We arrived to Pale. It's a little village. I've never been at that village. And they said, ma'am, where do you want me to drop you off? I said, I have no idea. And they dropped me off in front of the police station, and they left. I looked around like a slow motion camera, 360 several times. And I saw like a two football fields far away. A man, half an inch tall, going away. Kind of a, something familiar. And I realized, oh my God, my husband has a cousin here, and I knew his name. His name was Misha. But how likely is that I see one guy in Pale and that's his cousin? I decided this must be Misha, and I started screaming his name 10, 15, 20 times, screaming. My yelling turned into a real screaming with tears, because if I stop, I have no other idea what to do. After maybe 20 times, the person turned around, started running towards me. And when he was close enough, he says, "Nada, is it you?" He took me to his home. Wow, clean house, hot shower, wonderful dinner that I couldn't eat. My kids ate the dinner, Wiener Schnitzel and chicken soup and all these wonderful things. I couldn't believe that we used to eat this kind of food. But Pale never had war, even though it's so close to Sarajevo. We went outside for a little bit to walk with kids in a little park that was very close. We let them swing in the swings. It was so surreal to me, the silence and my kids happy in the swings. We came home. She made some crepes with chocolate. The boys were loving it. They were just, oh my goodness, all chocolate was around their faces and they were so happy. So in my mind, I felt we made it, but I didn't say anything. I thought at that point that we saved our lives. I didn't know the war is happening all over Bosnia. I thought it's only in Sarajevo. And in my journey, I had to go further through the land of Bosnia to get to Serbia. Misha bought bus tickets for next day for 7 a.m. for us to go from Pale to Belgrade, capital of Serbia. I did manage to call my father from Pale and said, we are getting into that bus. In the bus, there was only women and kids below the age of being recruited for the army. And we started our journey. That's usually 5 hours driving distance. I remember seeing villages bombed, whole village emptied. I saw killed big animals like cows and horses on the edge of the road. Throughout that journey, we were stopped by at least 13 very unusual group of men. Several of them had some kind of a army uniform, some of them didn't. They would come in and ID every single one of us, and then they would leave. It would repeat over and over again. There was a grandma in front of me on the other side of the bus that was hiding a young teenager who would be in that age bracket to join the army. And every time somebody stopped the bus and these weird characters walked in, he would go underneath the seat and she would cover him with a blanket. And I have a feeling it was for a reason that he was right there where I was sitting. I would start talking to the guy and kind of distract him to take him away from this boy. I never talked to the grandma. I never talked to this boy. Bus was absolutely full of passengers. Nobody exchanged one word with each other. Several hours later, the bus stopped again, and there was a new border in between Bosnia and Serbia. There was no border in between our republics before. So a little man-made kiosk and a soldier. He says, "You need to turn around, go back to Sarajevo because Serbia is not accepting refugees anymore." As soon as I heard that, I took my kids and I walked outside and the soldier said, "What are you doing, ma'am?" I said, "I'm not a refugee. I am from Novi Sad. I'm going home. I'm not a refugee." And they both said, "Ma'am, go back to the bus. So it's war, so you don't..." I mean, I tried. I tried not to go back to Sarajevo, wouldn't you? Go back to hell? I would rather walk for days than go back to get killed. Five hours sitting in the bus and waiting. I hear the driver turn on the engine and we left. I don't know why and who decided to let us go. So approaching to Belgrade, my father, he was waiting for probably 6 hours. We arrived and I saw him through the window. He saw me and he collapsed on the floor. And I picked up my kids and walked outside. I said, "Dad, why are you crying? I'm here. I was safe." He says, "When the bus was late for 1 hour, 2 hours, 3 hours, I went to the information window and I said, 'When is that bus coming from Pale that left at 7 a.m.?'" He says, "I don't know." "So what do you mean, I don't know?" He said, "Well, the previous bus never arrived." "What do you mean the previous bus never arrived? How come buses don't arrive? Where are they?" He says, "Well, the groups of criminals in this mountains stopped the bus. The criminals knew if you're leaving your whole life and you can't carry anything, you can carry a little cash and a little jewelry. So they killed everybody in the bus to steal little valuables." When my father heard that, he is the only person surviving Holocaust, and his entire family, including his 9-year-old sister, died in Auschwitz. He just couldn't handle this. He decided to stay there until I arrive. Even now, I think about that. What did I do to deserve to be on that other bus? How lucky I was. I think about this often. We drove from Belgrade to Novi Sad. It's 1 hour and 15 minutes. Very soon we went to shower and to bed. My mom's and dad's apartment is very small, and we slept on the floor using the cushions from the sofa, and we would hug each other very close. And I noticed Ivan would climb underneath me in the middle of the night to feel safe. I wasn't able to sleep. I go out to go for a walk, and my dad said, "Why are you going in the middle of the night? It's not safe." Of course it's safe. Nobody is shooting and bombing me. So of course I can go to walk and smell the air and be outside and listen how silence feels.
Nada's husband made it out of Sarajevo safe and sound. He reunited with his family after 100 days apart on a train station platform in Budapest. That story came to us from producer Brianna Breen in the podcast Lucky. And you want to check out the Lucky podcast to listen to part 2 of Nada's incredible story. Find out what happened next. There'll be a link on our website, snapjudgment.org. You can also see pictures of Nada's life before the war at snapjudgment.org. Music in this episode is from Blue Dot Sessions, produced with help from Natasha Ruck and Tony Gannon. Special thanks as well to David Newsom, Tom Wirth, Robert Rothbard, and Nada Rothbard. In just a moment, is being a little bit dead better than being a whole lot dead? Find out when Lucky episode continues. Stay tuned. from WNYC Studios. You're listening to Snap Judgment, the lucky episode. My name is Glenn Washington, and from a lifetime of television crime shows, I know that when a patient dies in the hospital, a doctor pronounces them dead, comforts the family, switches off the monitors, pulls the curtain shut, and then moves on to her next job. I know because I've seen the whole thing go down, but what happens to the patient's body afterward? Hospital administrator Galen Lazarson has the story live.
How's that? Okay. So I'd like you to remember the first time that your pager went off. Where were you? How did you feel? What was the call? For me, it was 1:30 in the morning on a Wednesday, and I was dead asleep. And I jolted awake in my bed, and I grabbed the pager, and I started pushing buttons frantically, trying to read the message and terrified that I would delete it. So every week, a hospital executive serves as the administrator on call, the AOC, responsible for managing any major operational issues or crises that come up. For the most part, the AOC pager doesn't go off that frequently. Most departments, IT, facilities, nursing, let's say, handle issues on their own or with some help from the on-site hospital supervisor. For an issue to get to the AOC, something's gone awry. This is the management equivalent of multi-system organ failure. So, as you'd expect, we debrief after every call to make sure that the issues don't repeat themselves. So as a new fellow in hospital administration, the only thing I could be certain of when I answered a page was that it would be something I had never dealt with before. So we're back to Wednesday at 1:30 a.m., and I return the page, and I say, "This is Galen Lasserson, first responder AOC. What seems to be the problem?" And then the hospital supervisor tells me the refrigerator's broken. Okay, I think that doesn't seem like such a big deal. Which refrigerator? And she tells me, the morgue. Lesson number one, the morgue is a fridge, not a freezer. Now, they didn't cover this one in business school, so I start with a strategy that my friend Nicole swears got her through her intern year. I see. Now, what do you normally do when that happens? No luck. Morgue's been trucking along just fine for about 15 years, and as an added bonus, the hospital supervisor now thinks I'm incompetent. So, when in doubt, it's always a good idea to start with nursing. And I call the nursing supervisor, and I say, you know, we have a bit of a situation. This might be hard, but if you had to estimate, how many people do you think we might, you know, like lose tonight? And she says, tonight, pretty matter-of-factly, one, Mr. James on the 13th floor. Wow, okay, that was specific. So, got it, need room for Mr. James. But even more pressing was what we were going to do with the body that was coming out of organ harvesting shortly. This was like a macabre math problem. Did I want one very warm body in the morgue anteroom plus 16 cool ones in the morgue refrigerator, or did I open the door and land myself with 17 lukewarm bodies? Well, I said to the nursing supervisor, what if we open the door and we just put the body in really, really quickly? And it wasn't the most scientific approach, but it didn't seem any worse than any other option we had. So with that covered, I called facilities and pathology, and we agreed on a morning meeting in the morgue to come up with a plan. So the next morning, I arrive at the morgue a little early because, I was awake. And and I watched two pathology residents perform a neonatal autopsy. And one of them says, "Look at the tiny spleen," and then, "It's so cute." So I went and looked at the morgue refrigerator, and it temperature had gone up by about 6 degrees, and I was back at the math. So, you know, if we normally store bodies at 2 degrees Celsius, and the morgue's now at 14 degrees Celsius, and it's rising at a rate of 1.5 degrees every hour, I was going to have a really big problem on my hands in about 5 hours. Although, what actually happens to bodies when they get warm? I asked the pathologist, I was like, you know, do they smell? Is it a really bad smell? Lesson number two, it's not that warm bodies smell, it's that they drip fluid everywhere. Gross. So facilities is waiting on a part from the manufacturer, and we start to come up with alternative contingency plans. Someone suggests the Laboratory Animal Research Center. Lesson number three, we have a morgue for animals, which, incidentally, was working just fine. So the question is, could we move some of the bodies to the morgue for the animals, just temporarily? And one look around at the faces in the room made the answer to that pretty clear. I mean, yes, but no. No, we can't. I mean, technically, this does no harm, at least from the patient's perspective, but it just didn't seem respectful. I also couldn't shake the idea of my boss waking up in the morning to a headline that read, "Hospital administrator stuffs bodies into animal freezer, stored next to pigs." So start to think, okay, is there another place that we could get rid of the bodies to? Is there another way to handle this? And for that, I had to seek out patient relations. Now, when a patient dies on a medical television show, which, of course, they almost never do, we see the physician inform the family of the death, and maybe we see the patient's family's reaction. I always wish we could stay with the family and see what happens next. In the hospital, what happens next for the family falls into the realm of patient relations, specifically decedent affairs, who are the experts in logistics. Death leaves the living with a surprising number of logistics. I remember sitting with my friend Shireen a few years ago. My stepfather had died around the same time as her mother, and amidst all of this, we found ourselves discussing logistics. What do you do with the body? Who calls family friends to let them know? How do you get a death certificate or plan the service, place an obituary? I used to think that bereavement leave existed because it's so hard for us to do anything or to function when we are grieving. I didn't realize it was because there's so much stuff to get done. Assuming, of course, that there's someone there to do it. When I looked at the list of patients in the morgue, I thought there must be some kind of mistake. There were patients listed who had died in December, and we were now approaching February. Lesson number four, patients can hang out in the morgue for a while. When a patient dies without family, it's the Office of Public Administration that's tasked with tracking down the next of kin. And this can take a while. They could go to the city morgue, but this is San Francisco, and unfortunately, even the morgue has a wait list. So by the next... Thank you for that. Sure enough, before the sun has risen, we came up with a plan that everybody agreed on, and decedent affairs would call the mortuaries to pick up the bodies. Nursing would move the neonatal bodies into a smaller working refrigerator upstairs, and facilities anticipated having the repair completed by the end of the day, and if not, they were going to look into the option of refrigerated trucks. So I emerged from the morgue into a hallway full of staff in light blue scrubs doing pre-dawn yoga before the start of the morning shift. And there was something that made sense about that much vibrant, peaceful life on the other side of the wall from death. I watched them for a few minutes. Then I went upstairs to my boss's office to debrief him on the plan. That was when I learned lesson number five. There's an AOC emergency manual, and it has a protocol titled Morgue.
Nocturnus is a live storytelling event for doctors and other healthcare workers based in San Francisco. Its host and creator is Emily Silverman, MD. Its executive producer is Allie Block, MD. And its podcast producer is Marina Poole. Special thanks to Emily Shaw and Celine Ross. The Nocturnist has its own podcast. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. We'll have a link at snapjudgment.org. Now then, California is home to the largest women's prison in the world. And every year on Mother's Day, a special bus travels across the state, bringing kids and grandmas to see their mom in prison. We're going to hop on that bus and walk into the visiting room.
Wanda Cummings, and we're going to California Central Women's Facility in Chowchilla. I got Jericho Cummings, which is my grandson, going to see his mother, Cassandra.
My name is Jericho, and I'm 11. I'm going to see my mom.
Just something that I feel like they need to do to keep in touch with their mom, because it's like she tell me, don't ever let her boys forget her. And I'm like, no, I cannot do that, you know.
Hello, my name is Pearl Gordon. I'm raising 3 great-grandchildren. For my granddaughter. Well, hey, we've been doing it now for 12 years. We've been visiting her. So she hasn't missed out on their growing up. It's so hard on the family. Because if you got someone in prison, you're in prison. You're in prison too.
My name's Cassandra McGraw, and I'm visiting my family at CCWF. My sons and my mother-in-law. I'm in here for robbery, and I tell them, don't do it. Don't do anything to break the law, because it's not worth losing your freedom. It's not worth messing up your life. When I do ask them, you know, what do people say? Do your friends know? You know, their whole demeanor changes, and they're like, yeah, they know, and they're sad. It seems like our kids are the ones that's paying the price more than we are, and that's what hurts the most.
Okay, my name is Jason Powell. I'm 12. I'm here visiting my mom. I've asked her many times what she did to get in here, and she's told me that she was with a man who had killed somebody, and she was there when it happened.
My name is Keita. These are my kids and my grandma. I got a life sentence, so they ask me, when are you coming home? And I tell them, not for a long time.
Let me see inside your ear. You gotta start cleaning inside your ears.
I do.
You do?
I missed a couple days.
Yeah, you. So cute.
I want you to come with us.
I can't, baby.
Why?
It's because I can. I gotta stay here.
No, you gotta come with us. Come on.
I can't. Yeah. You gotta let go, Nene.
Let go.
Bye, Mom.
Bye, baby. I love you guys.
Okay, Grandma.
That piece was produced by Anna Sussman and Julia DeWitt. Now, Glenn, that was an amazing show. I wonder where we could find more incredible Snap Judgment programming. Friends, have I got news for you. Stunning Snap Judgment episodes, including The Badlands, Fargo, Inside San Quentin with Ear Hustle, and the Senior Year Mixtape, where we follow behind a group of high school seniors for a full year, and what we discover, Lord have mercy. All of this and more on the Snap Judgment podcast for free. Binge. If you dig it, leave a review of Snap Judgment on the iTunes. If you don't dig it, please leave a review for This American Life. I'm Ira Glass. Snap is produced by the team that always gets lucky, if you know what I mean. Everyone except for the Uber producer, Mr. Mark Ristich, Smooth Talking Pat Massini Miller, Anna Chamomile T. Sussman, Nancy Massage Lotion Lopez, Renzo Simon Clothes Gorio, Satin Shayna Sheely, Liz Burlap Matt, Eliza Cotton Smith, Tail Wild Honey Descartes, Adiza Bird Songs Mixtape Egan,
Leon, whipped cream Morimoto, and Jasmine Aguilera likes ice with her cream. And yes, we're scouring the globe, searching for stories for the new season of Spook dropping late this summer. If you have a story of your long-term encounter with the supernatural, let us know. Snapjudgment.org. And even though this is not the news, no way is this the news. In fact, you could hit every lottery number the announcer calls out for the big prize, only to realize you're looking at last week's ticket. You would still not be as far away from the news as this is. But this is WNYC.